Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. Everybody, welcome to the kitchen table. Thank you so much for being with us here. Oh, sitting around the table drinking a little coffee and enjoying the day. And I have surrounding me some of my good friends. I have Michelle York.
I'm one of your good friends?
Absolutely. You're one of my good friends. You're sitting at the table. You don't get to this table by not being a good friend.
Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Well, you're my friend, too.
And across the wall over there, I have the Slama, huh? Slama, what's going on over there?
Oh, not too much. Just enjoying this weather. I tell you, it gets better and better here in Louisiana. You forget about August after a while.
Oh, my God. Isn't it easy? But you know what's strange is that one day it's cold as could be. The other day it's hot. You never know what to wear. That's why everybody's sniffling all the time. You know what I mean?
You have difficulty with your wardrobe.
My wardrobe, yeah. Today I have my camp shirt on, so to speak. This is my outdoor camp shirt, I call this. What do you think?
I like it.
You like it, huh?
I didn't know you had camp shirts.
Yeah, I have camp wear from camouflage to the sporting set that I wear like this right here. It's called a sporting set. Like when I walk in, people know I know what I'm doing. They say, he knows what he's doing. Look at that shirt he's got on. See?
I see.
Huh? Mr. Flannel in the studio this morning.
Or as we call it in St. James Parish, we call it flannelette. Michelle, what have you been doing all week, huh? I hadn't seen you all week long.
Just working.
What are you working on?
I've been
on?
Having this research paper due.
Yeah? Getting it together?
Yep. About to turn it in.
Well, good, good. You remember when I broke my foot a couple of years ago?
Remember how I nursed you back to health?
You nursed me back to health. You were an angel sent to me by the good Lord, I have to say. And when I finally, after 3 months walking around on crutches in a wheelchair, Michelle would say, okay, let's go outside. The doctor said you should be able to put a little weight on your foot. And I'd say, okay, let's go outside. I was very skeptical, and we'd get outside, and I'd put my arm around, and she'd put her arm around my waist, and we'd start to walk. I'd try to put a little bit of weight on the foot, and she'd say, put one foot in front of the other, and soon we'll be walking out. So I'm telling you, 3 years left, put one foot in front of the other, and soon you will be a theologian. How you like that?
Huh? Very nice.
That was a pretty good little song.
That was a very good song.
Anyway, y'all, hey, welcome again, as I say. And Michelle, my favorite question. Do you know what season we're really in right now? Do you have any idea?
Is that a trick question?
No, it's not a trick question. What are you talking about?
I mean...
Because I was seasons of the year. You know what I'm talking about.
We just turned the clocks back not long ago and a lot of football games on. I mean, that screams fall. Why are you asking me that?
You know, it might be fall or autumn, as the educated call it. As a native Louisianian and a Cajun by birth and a gift of God, you should know that we never, ever, ever define seasons as winter, spring, summer, and fall, not here in Cajun country. Our seasons are celebrated and determined by what's running, what's slithering, what's swimming, or what's flying in our swamps and rivers. That's the season of the year we're in. You know what I mean? Huh?
So we're in hunting season.
We are in hunting season. It's a passion and a recreation here, right?
And it's our heritage. And in many cases, our livelihood. Hunting just seems to be in a Louisianian's DNA.
I would say that's true. My dad and my five brothers were avid hunters. You know, even before the colonists came and settled Louisiana, the wilds of this country were being walked by the Cadidabois. The Cadidabois, the runners of the woods, they were hunting and trapping and trading throughout the Louisiana territory prior to the late 1600s. And of course, they kind of set the mark that we all try to travel through today or reach today. We try to be modern day Cadidabois this time of year. And young boys growing up in the swamps of Louisiana are expected, they have a lot of peer pressure to become hunters and in many cases trappers, because trapping is coming back a little bit.
Were you expected to be a hunter and a trapper?
I was expected to be a hunter and a trapper. I was expected to be skilled at the hunt, so to speak. I was expected to bring in my share of bounty to feed the hungry mouths around our starving table back in those early days of growing up in St. James Parish, St. Jacques de Cabanossi, as they call it, which was the Homa Indian word for clearing where mallard ducks roost. So do you think I should have been a hunter?
What happened?
Well, I had a lot of brothers who would hunt, and I would have a little bit of trouble when we'd go hunt.
Couldn't keep your mouth closed? You couldn't be quiet?
You see, Slama, she wants to slam me now. You see what I'm talking about, huh?
No respect.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. They wouldn't let me go. But I had another problem, too. I had bad eyesight back then. I used to wear these glasses, and my brother would say, look, because it was my turn to shoot, you see.
They gave you a turn.
Well, there was six of us. There was six of us, and we'd all be hunting, and we'd all be in formation. I mean, it was like the British taking the Battle of New Orleans, you know. And we each had our front and back sacks that we had over us, and we had our shells, you know, in the front sack, and we had the game in the back, you know what I mean? So we had our headlights, because we were illegal. And the game knew we were coming, you know what I mean? So we would walk through the swamp on those drizzly nights, and all of us had our headlights on. And my oldest brother, my boy, would say, look, John, here's your turn. Look, you see it over there. You see the eyes over there? And I said, what eyes? He said, look, right over there to the left. You see the eyes? I said, well, what eyes? I don't see any eyes. He said, look, they're looking right at you. You don't see them? You don't see them? That's a woodcock. They got three up right there. You see six eyes right there. I said, I don't see any eyes. He said, get out of the way. Bum, bum, bum. He go pick up three woodcocks. They were like 2 feet away from me. Then he said, you know what? You just can't see in the dark. So we're going to go and lay down on the levee. And we're going to put our gun straight up in the air. And when the ducks fly over or the geese fly over, we're just going to pop two or three of them out of there. They're easy to hit because he said, you know, they're just floating up there.
So you'll be a piece of cake.
A piece of cake. So we'd go lay down on a sheet on the levee. You know, we'd go put it across there. And we'd tell stories and wait for them to come. And all of a sudden, the ducks and the geese would start to fly over. And it was like a military barrage going on. The ducks would be flying everywhere except on top of me. That's where the term you couldn't hit the side of a barn came from. So I went home dejected one day, and I told Mary Fashio, you know, that wonderful woman who raised us after Mom died and took care of us and taught us how to cook. I said, I don't know about all this hunting. I can't hit anything. I can't see it at night. She said, but you can cook it. She said, you know, nobody cooks stuff better than me. Why don't you come on in the kitchen while you and I cook it and let them go get it? I said, Mary, you got something going there because it's cold out there anyway. So there began my life as a game cook.
And being a game cook is very important, a camp cook.
That's right.
Camps, it's kind of a ritual of South Louisiana, and it is a tradition and an honor I have come to learn. Not just anybody can be the camp cook. You've told me that whether the camp is a Tilton Hilton or a mansion in the marsh, all swamp cooking begins with a cured cast iron pot.
Let me tell you something. Many of our legendary swamp floor delicacies developed in these family heirloom pots. We used to call them heirloom cookery because they'd be handed down from generation to generation. And about every third generation, and I'll just use you as an example here, they'd go to somebody who really didn't treasure them as much as somebody else. And
you don't think I'd treasure them.
Well, I'm just saying, you may not treasure a pot as much as I would, so they'd put it on the banister rail of the back porch. And it would sit there for another generation growing mother-in-law tongues or ivies or hang over the porch. So then the next generation would come along and they said, isn't that one of those great old cast iron pots that mother-in-law tongues in? Oh, yeah, old grandma couldn't cook in it. They said, dump that thing out there, let's scrub it down with a brick and clean it up, get the rust out, and next generation it cooked again. We call it heirloom cookware. It was handed down from generation to generation. And what cook growing up in the swamps of Louisiana isn't familiar with the cooking skills of my great uncle, my grandfather's brother, Uncle Paul Zarang? Talk about legendary. Everybody in the world knew him. He was the master at cooking game. His recipes live on in the pots of camp cooks up and down the bayous today. To master the skills and to be destined to be a camp cook is a distinction. Well, it's kind of like the coronation is of the son of a king or queen in England. That's the only thing you can equate it to. So if you're heir apparent to the pots at the hunting camp, mm-hmm. to become the hunting camp cook.
Got a little bit of clout there.
Not only clout, I mean, people know it. They'll say, you see him over there? He's the camp cook. Mm-hmm. And everybody say, wow, he is? Think we could talk to him? Oh, yeah, that's the way it is. But it is a great honor. You know, fathers, sons, grandsons, all in the swamps of Louisiana bond over that swarthy pot of etouffees and gumbos and sauce pecans. And future cooks are just born as they learn to mince and chop and dice and help. Because even as young boys, 7, 8, 9 years old, we were around the table at Uncle Paul's camp, and we had the privilege of picking up an old hickory knife and chopping and dicing through an onion and being patted on the head by Uncle Paul, and he'd lean over and said, "A little small on that dice right there." And then you knew exactly what he meant. You didn't even look up.
Those are wonderful memories, and I know that you treasure them, too.
I do treasure them, and I do have his pots, as you know. I was given all of Uncle Paul's pots, and I treasure them today. I am the keeper of the pots. No mother-in-law tongues in these pots.
Definitely not. Louisiana truly is blessed. It's not by accident that we're called sportsman's paradise. Game is abundant here in the state. South Louisiana is uniquely positioned, if you think about it, to offer some of the best wild game hunting in the country. Not only are our marshes and wetlands home year-round to many, many species of waterfowl, but we are the culmination of the Mississippi Flyway. So every year, thousands upon thousands of geese and ducks winter here. This is their home away from home.
It's kind of called a suicide mission.
Interestingly, about a quarter of the nation's dabbling ducks spend a portion of the winter here, and mallards and pintails, grays, teals, geese, you can find all of them in the marshes.
Well, you know, and there's nothing better for a holiday table. I love the Christmas goose, which is where the tradition of the Christmas goose comes about. Because, I mean, the speckle-bellied geese, which are most hunters really love, are, as we hunters and camp cooks call it, ribeye in the sky. And you may not know it, but teal is one of my favorite, as well as wood duck. Talk about a great centerpiece for the table, kind of like that Swampsgiving table, right?
Right. Huh? We have a lot of land fowl, too. We're talking about the marshes, but, I mean, you've got pheasant and doves and chucker, all great sport for hunters in the state.
Woodcock, pheasant, as my brother said. Anyway, y'all, we're talking about hunting today, and we're talking about how we learn to cook and how we become camp cooks in Louisiana, but we're mainly talking about game and this great tradition of hunting and eating game in Louisiana, and you don't want to miss one word of it. We have a great guest, good recipe, so we'll be back in just a second.
Well, the moon is right and I'm hand-tied. My life is just beginning. I won't go hunting with you, Jake, but I'll go chasing women. Let's go down to the meeting house and wait till they start home. Them gals that live on Possum Creek will always leave alone. We'll run them down the corn roads, them sassy little misses. We'll scare them pretty gals to death, we'll stop and throw them kisses. Well, I won't go hunting with you, Jake, but I'll go chasing women. So put them hounds back in the pen.
Greetings. I'm Jake Hebert.
And I'm Adam Chouard. Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM KRVS.
Hi, I'm Pete Bergeron. If your day starts early, like mine does, let's spend it together with Cajun music from 5 to 7 a.m. here at Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, now broadcasting in HD radio technology.
In a fishing boat. Well, I live in the city, but don't fit in. You know it's a pity, the shape I'm in. But I got no home and I got no choice. Oh, Lord, have mercy on the country boy.
Everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting food and culture show on radio. And today we're talking about wild game for the holiday table. Michelle, during the break, we were talking about the great hunters, the Native Americans, who were some of the first culinary instructors as well when it came to teaching, you know, the early colonists how to cook in the seasoned meat and to cook all those exotic game they had never seen before, like raccoons and squirrel and muskrat and possum and all that kind of stuff. I want to talk about that a little bit more, but right now we have a great friend and guest on the phone with us who knows more about hunting than anybody I know. And a good cook, too.
And a good cook. Yeah. That's
He and I fried french fries together one day at the camp.
We have Jimmy Riley with us on the show today, and we met Jimmy a few years ago working on the After the Hunt cookbook and working on the After the Hunt television series. Jimmy's a native of Natchez, Mississippi. He earned a bachelor's degree in agricultural engineering, technology, and business from Mississippi State University. Now, we're not holding that against him, John. He's a good guy.
No, we're not.
He is a good guy, a great friend. After graduating, he spent 9 years managing a poultry processing plant, and then he found the job he was born to do.
And right near home.
And right near home. That's exactly right. Since 1996, Jimmy has been the general manager of Giles Island Hunting Club, where he takes care of everything. I mean, everything on the island. He guides hunts. He guides fishing trips. And, you know, we've pulled him out of the woods today just to talk to us.
Yeah, we're always pulling him out of the woods. You know that?
So, Jimmy, it's so great to have you on Stern It Up with us today. Thanks for being here.
Well, I appreciate y'all thinking about me. And, hey, I got to know one thing. Was that Chef Foles singing that song a while ago?
That was me singing that song. How you like that?
No, it wasn't. I think you sang before, and that wasn't you.
Jimmy, I was in Tennessee last week, and I'll be doggone if somebody wasn't talking about you and Giles Island. They said the greatest hunting club in America is in Mississippi, they told me. And I said, yeah. And they said, right in the middle of the river. I said, Giles Island. He said, absolutely. You know Giles Island? I said, I sure do. He said, you know Jimmy? I said, of course I know Jimmy. You kidding me? I said, Jimmy was the one who showed me how to shoot at a turkey.
But hey, I got to agree with that guy. This is the greatest place to hunt in America.
We were standing in a room drinking a good bottle of big red wine, and he was sitting there talking about had been there two or three times. He was from up north, and he was going on and on and on. So I haven't seen you in a year or so, and you know, I think of you often and appreciate getting texts every now and then about the last trophy, and wow, it's some kind of deer season last year, huh?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I've been here 15 years, and we just finished our 12th year selling hunts to the public, you know, commercial hunting, and we just had our best year ever last year.
Wow. Well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, just for people who don't know where Giles Island is or what it's all about, before we get too deep into it, I need you to really give our listeners a good view of exactly where is and what is Giles Island.
We are down here in southwest Mississippi between Natchez, Mississippi and Faraday, Louisiana. We are exactly in the middle of the river. It used to not be an island. In 1933, the Corps of Engineers dredged the Giles Cutoff straight in the course of the river, and that created an island out of this piece of property. It is Adams County, Mississippi, but you can hunt it with Mississippi or Louisiana license. That's important for people to know, especially down in your area.
Right, right.
9,400 acres, 15 square miles, and boy, it is one of these unique pieces of property. You know, they don't make any more of them, and they never will, so we're keeping it just as natural as we can, just enhancing it a little bit here and there. You know, a lot of deer on the property, that's our main thing, but a lot of other wildlife also.
Now, you were saying just a minute ago that this was the best year yet. Tell us what made it the best year yet.
Well, we killed a great number of bucks. Now, maybe not quite as many as we have some other years before, just by, you know, missed it by 5 or 10, but the quality of the deer that we harvested, the top end of what we harvested was better than we've done in the past 15 years. Now, what made it like that? Well, of course, we had the big flood, you know, the year before.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, people were scared to come hunt with us because they didn't think we would have any deer because they knew the deer had to leave because the whole island flooded. But that's not what made us have the best year. What made us have the best year ever is our management program. We started shooting deer by age 2 years ago, and, man, it is working. And I expect we're going to have another great year this year.
So it's all about the big trophy bucks because you're managing and killing only those as they get to that stage where you know when it comes down it's going to be one of the biggest and the best that they have an opportunity to shoot.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's three requirements to have your bucks be all they can be. That's nutrition, genetics, and then the last thing is age. And we've got the genetics here. There's been big deer on this island, you know, ever since I can remember, but not a lot of them. And, of course, we've got the food for them, nutrition. Naturally, it's here. It's in this river bottom with all this river silt. It's just fertile as can be, and we enhance it all we can with supplemental feeding and food plots and stuff. And the last thing is what a lot of people are not able to do because they don't have a big piece of property and their neighbors are shooting all their deer. But we've got this big piece of property and we've got total control over all these deer. And we're putting the age on them and we're letting them all grow to the age to be all they can be before we harvest them.
Wow. Now, I know that Speed Bancroft was a good friend of ours, of course, purchased Giles Island many years ago. And it's he who had the vision, I guess, of the island as a hunting club. And I know that Mr. B thinks absolutely the world of you. You brought his vision to life, no doubt about that. Tell us about the early beginnings. How did you kind of get together with Mr. B? How did that happen that y'all came together and now you're so well known as the guy who leads that vision for him over there?
Well, I just kind of lucked into this job. Like Michelle said a while ago, I worked in a chicken plant for 9 years. And I hated every minute of that. You're talking to a man that when I was a kid, that's all I ever wanted to do was hunt fish. I had no other desires, you know, a little bit of baseball and stuff. But, man, that chicken plant was killing me. And I got out of home. I heard Mr. Bancroft had bought the island, and I just sent him a cold letter and resume, and he was needing somebody, and it worked out. So I came over here in 1996. He bought the island in 1992, and, well, he really didn't know what he wanted to do with it for sure. He had just needed to buy some land. He had been looking for several years, and he loved to hunt and fish and stuff. And when he found this property, he knew this was the one he was meant to have. But he didn't really know what he was going to do with it, and I came on board in 96. Then the very next year, he said, Jimmy, come up with a plan to cover these expenses over here. So I came up with a three-day hunting plan, like a lot of other people do across the country, you know. And it was back in the day, you know, when there weren't a lot of outfitters out there. There were some, but not like it is now. Of course, we were going to go in 98, and then we had the big flood in 97. And Mr. Bancroft said, hold the fort. We're not selling any hunts. We're not going to have any deer. I said, wait a minute, Mr. B. I said, the deer come back. I know they all left. But they come back. I grew up down here in Natchez, and I've been watching these floods my whole life. He said, well, I can't take any chances. I can't get guests over here and not have any deer. So we didn't do it that year. And sure enough, the next season, he saw that all the deer came back. Some of the same bucks he saw last year, he saw again. And he said, oh, well, I'm not worried about the flood anymore. Let's sell the hunt. So we started in 1999, and we were just fortunate that, you know, in this little hunting industry we have, around this country, it gets to be a small world, and word gets out quick. And, you know, we were the new place coming up back then, but we got a lot of guests right off the bat. And thanks to Mossy Oak, you know, they come over and make a couple of TV shows every year and spread the word, you know, on national TV. Well, we've been fortunate to have a lot of good hunters over here on the island over the years and just keep it rocking along.
Jimmy, one of the things that when we've gone up there and just sitting and talking with you, you've told us about the deer, and I mean, you know every deer on that island. And tell us about the night before a hunt, because you actually brief your guests on the deer that are out there, where they've been traveling, what they can expect to find, even to showing them videos.
Yeah. Well, I wish I could tell you that I knew every deer on the place, but my memory is not that good enough. We got about 1,000 deer over here, and half of them are bucks. And the place is so big, there's just no way to keep a record on everything that we have. As a matter of fact, I don't think we see everything that we have every year. I think there's maybe 2 or 3% of these bucks that we never see at all. Some of them are just more nocturnal than others, but we do get to see a lot of them. And a lot of them have certain distinguishable characteristics about their antlers where we can recognize them from one year to the next. And we capture this video because all of our they're one-on-one guided, and the guide has a video camera. So we get to learn these deer and where they hang out. And some of them stick to a core area, and some of them spread around a little bit. Yeah, and when one of our hunters draws an area and draws a stand, we're going to take him to the video, the DVD, and show him what deer is in that area that he might have a chance to see, you know. No guarantees, but if the opportunity's there.
Now, Jimmy, one other thing. What about the availability of hunting throughout the year, throughout the season? I know we're talking about big buck and we're talking about deer hunting now, but what else goes on as far as hunting on the property all year long?
We do some turkey hunting. We're not this coming year because the recent floods have diminished the hatches that they were able to have. So the population's down a little bit on the turkey, so we're just going to give them a break this coming year. But we had a great hatch last year, but those baby turkeys are going to be Jake's this year. You know, they're not old enough to shoot. Although you would probably shoot one, I know.
You ought to be ashamed. It'd be safe for me to shoot him, Jimmy, because I wouldn't hit him.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, I wasn't going to hit, but I got a shirt tail over here with Chef John Fulton's name on it. But yeah, we have other things to do on Giles Island besides just deer hunting. You know, a little turkey hunting in the springtime and then fishing. I'm going to have some great socolay. Y'all call them socolay. We call them white perch.
Oh, yeah, socolay. That's the best fish swimming.
It is. And the Yankees up north call them crappie. So the white perch fishing, and along with your bream and your bass and your catfish and all that. And some great lakes on the island. I mean, we got Marengo Lake, Bad Lake, Blue Hole, the Chute. And the Corps of Engineers is digging us a new lake up there right now. They're putting dirt on the levee around Vidalia, and we're going to have a new 70-acre lake up there. It's going to get restocked every year by the river, just like everything else. So we have fishing trips, and we are trying to get some corporate groups in here. We had a couple this year. We can accommodate about 15 guests on the island. It's the best environment in the world for someone who wants to have a sales meeting or a safety meeting or something for their business, you know. These guys just love it, and we put in a regulation trap field on the island this past year.
Wow.
So, yeah, when a group comes over and they want to have some meetings and stuff, we'll put them in the trucks, and we'll give them a tour of the island and show them the place, and we'll shoot trap one day, you know. Everybody loves that, burn a little powder, you know, and shoot some clay targets. It's fun. And, you know, we can do some fishing. And, you know, something else we did 2 years ago, we invited Chef John Foltz over here, and he put on the best cooking school that anybody's ever heard of. Now, that was a huge hit. And we're going to do it again this year, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. I told Michelle the other day. Michelle called me. She said, we got to find a time on your calendar for John's Island. I said, let me tell you something, Michelle. We need to do that cooking school. You found something for me, Michelle?
I have a tentative date, but before I give it to him, I got to talk to you about just a couple little
Jimmy, surrounding things, but I think
we've got it.
Jimmy, I guarantee you I'm coming up there. You can believe it. She and I just had a big old conversation about it. You know, I wanted to tell you also, I've come to appreciate more than anything else being on Giles Island, the importance of the hunting guide and the camaraderie formed between the hunting guide and the hunter. I'm sure there's challenges in finding the right person to guide for you and to work for you. What makes a good guide?
First thing I look for, and I've been through a lot of guides over the years, and of course we need a lot of guides because, you know, we take 12 hunters a day. So we need 12 guides here full time through the season. And the first thing I look for is the personality. I want someone here that's going to be able to socialize with the guests and make sure these guys have a good time. You know, whether the deer are moving or not, you know, they need to have a good time. Sometimes the deer don't always move, so you need some good conversation up there in the tree, you know. Personality. Someone can get along with Bubba, and they can get along with the CEO of a corporation. You know, real polite social skills and everything. Second thing is they need to have a little woodsmanship skills about them. I mean, they need to know their way around the woods, you know, how to read the deer sign, how to set up on the deer and find the deer and all that kind of thing. The third thing, really, we can train it, and that's how to score and age these bucks. We can train them, and I always tell them, I said, I want you to forget everything you know about deer and learn it our way. Because you know, my little thing that circulates out there in the deer industry is the way we do things, but what we're doing is working. Like I said, we just had our best season ever, so. That's the three main things we're looking for in a guide. And it is hard to find people that don't have a full-time job that want to come down and do this just for 4 months out of the year. So we're very fortunate. We've got a lot of good people working on the island, both full-time employees and the part-time guides. But we're always looking for one or two more guides. If there's anybody out there listening, just shoot me an email. It's jimmy@gilesisland.com, and we'll get you on the list for next year.
we're going to make sure we put that on our website. One last question for you, Jimmy, because I know y'all busy over there. Michelle had a hand up.
I wanted you to tell us about Deer Thugs a little bit. Love the name of that.
Oh, wow. I tell you what, I feel very fortunate. First of all, you know, hats off to Mr. Bancroft, Mr. Speed Bancroft, for purchasing this island and then making it available to the general public to enjoy. This is a private island, but he's making it available to the public. You know, it's not one of these membership deals. It's a three-day hunt deal. Anybody can come. So hats off to him, and I really appreciate him taking me in as part of this thing, and I enjoy every minute of it. Cuz Strickland with Mossy Oak. He's the vice president of Mossy Oak Productions. He's originally from Natchez. I didn't know him beforehand, but when we started in 1999, he came down, and he's been coming down every year, and with his camo camera, the field producers from Mossy Oak, and making a few kills every year on national television, and that's what's been keeping us out there, you know, in front of everybody, and letting everybody know what we have to offer. And he came up with an idea. He had a vision of a new TV show called Deer Thugs. And he asked if I wanted to be a part of it. And I got permission from Mr. Bancroft. Once again, you know, Mr. Bancroft let me run with it. And I actually get to hunt a little bit now. Look, you know, for 15 years, I never hunted. All I did was guide. Now I get to hunt, you know, two or three times a year. I get to go hunting for the Deer Thugs TV show, and it's a really neat theme about the show. It's more of a question-answer type thing. There's five of us involved, two from Oklahoma, one from Texas, one from Alabama, and me. And they'll ask us questions, everything pertaining to deer and deer hunting and deer management and everything. And we just answer the questions, and sometimes our answers are all the same, and sometimes they get five different answers. It's really interesting. Of course, there'll be two hunts on every show also, so I just feel really fortunate to be involved with that thing, and everything's going fine, man. Everything's wonderful.
Well, look, Jimmy, you know, like I say, I really appreciate your time. I know how busy you are. I appreciate you speaking with us today. You're so generous with your time all the time, and I just want to tell you that I look so forward to seeing y'all again. I did tell Michelle we're going to definitely go back and do a couple cooking shows over there with you. And y'all, I want all you folks out there to know that we will have Jimmy Riley and Giles Island's information on our website, jfalls.com, and you must put it on your calendar. If you love to wake up and hunt, you have not hunted until you walked aside Jimmy Riley and the guides at Giles Island, because that's the place where, in my opinion, Jimmy, I think the good Lord goes to hunt. So anyway, thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to seeing you soon. Give Mr. B a hug for me, okay?
I'll show it, and y'all have a great weekend.
Thank you so much, Jimmy. We'll be back in just a minute, everybody.
I tried to sleep, but it was no use, because I am a brother to the old wild goose. God knows what the wild goose knows, and I must go where the wild goose goes. Wild goose, brother goose, which is best, a one-pin foot or a heart at rest?
Together and individually, they have been a creative and innovative force, the Brennans, the Fishers, the O'Donnells, the Cunninghams, and many more musical families. On the Thistle and Shamrock, hear how they have changed the sound of Celtic music.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
Comics avec Val. Bienvenue dans le monde francophone. C'est tous les jeudis à 9h sur KRVS, la radio Acadie.
Hi everyone, this is Pat Mitchell-Worley, and coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan, we're going to head to A. Schwab's on Bill Street in Memphis, Tennessee, and hear from the Patrick Dodd Trio. Then we go to the 2012 Memphis and May Bill Street Music Fest to hear from Robert Belfour. That plus the late Jerry Wexler continues his feature host series On the Record. That's all coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan.
tonight at 11 on KRVS.
T'as des misères à réveiller le dimanche matin? Mais allume la radio avec moi, Louis Michaud, tous les dimanches matins, 7h jusqu'à 9h. On va charrer en français, écouter la musique en français et boire une petite tasse de café. Join me, Louis Michaud, if you have trouble waking up in the Sunday mornings. Just turn your radio to KRVS from 7 to 9 and hear me with Le Réveil, The Awakening en français.
Like the sound when the day breaks.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best food and culture show on radio. We're so happy to have you with us today, and we're talking game. And Salam, I want to congratulate you on these folksy little hunting songs that you're doing now. So that's what we're looking for.
You gave me an opportunity to flex my country muscles today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. No, I like a good variety of music, obviously, but I mean, you're doing pretty good work there finding those little songs. See, that guy said, I just want to hope that you keep that hunting
alive. That was a nice compliment.
I'm normally known for my compliments. Huh? Right, Michelle?
I thought y'all were talking about the song was a nice compliment to the show.
Oh, no.
I didn't realize we were talking about you.
We try to keep it humble here on the Food and Culture Show.
Hey, let's take a second to remind everybody about Facebook, because we're wanting to encourage folks to just drop us a line every now and then. Tell us what you're cooking, what you're doing, what you're thinking, what you may want to hear on the show. So go to facebook.com/stirringitupradio.
It is a great venue. If you want to show off some of your foodies photos, we will accept them. We will repost them, and we'll just show off what you got, what you've been doing in the kitchen. We like to give a big shout out if you've been messing around in the kitchen.
Well, our stovehounds are always out there. Our listeners are always out there traveling around. They're always traveling through the back hills and byways of the country. You run into little restaurants. You run into little roadside stands. You find those unique little places that somebody's doing some butchering or something going on that we want to talk about. So there's no better eyes on the road for Stirring It Up than our stovehound, right?
I have one. On the Saturdays that I do have class, there is a vegetable and fruit truck that parks outside of Notre Dame Seminary, and some of the students go there and they buy fruit or whatever for lunch. It's a beautiful little roadside stand just right there outside the seminary.
Yeah, it's very nice. Facebook.com, Stirring It Up, Stirring, S-T-I-R-R-I-N. We need you to be bringing us up to date on important happenings that you find in the world of food along America's highways and byways. So, Michelle, what about, I'm going to do a good recipe in a minute, but you have a couple of good things to share, I'm sure, and cookbooks for the library are resources that should be on everybody's culinary shelf, right?
Well, as we were gathering research for the Wild Game Cookbook, I ran across a wonderful book related to hunting. And I chose it today because I think it is a nice addition to your culinary library. Not so much a cookbook, but a wonderful history of food book. It's entitled Fabulous Feasts, Medieval Cookery and Ceremony. It kind of stole my heart. Again, it's not so much about wild game cooking as it is about medieval celebratory feasts, where wild game, of course, was kind of the guest of honor. There's lots of good information in here about menus and the characteristics of medieval food and market laws, wines, music, costumes, and how to make menus for fabulous feasts. There's even a recipe section. One recipe that kind of caught my eye and I thought was kind of fun and that you would appreciate it too, 4 and 20 singing blackbird pie. Or, if you didn't want to do the blackbird,
24 was singing blackbird pie.
Yeah, okay. Or live frog and turtle pie.
Oh, I have that on the menu. Oh, live frog. Oh, whoa, live frog and turtle pie. Yeah, well, I'd have to back away from the table on that piece,
It's a wonderful little book. It's a great addition to the library. Fabulous Feasts, Medieval Cookery and Ceremony by Madeline Pellner Cosman. And we'll include that information on our website, jfolse.com.
Yeah, and y'all, even though this may not be a cookbook that you're going to pull out and cook a Saturday evening pork roast on or deer roast on, I mean, these are the type of books that round out a library. They're great conversation builders. Imagine sitting in a hunting camp all weekend or in a stand or sitting in a blind, and all of a sudden you can say, you know, they used to do live frog and turtle pie in medieval times.
Jimmy could use this.
That's what I'm saying.
We may need to send him a copy.
This is valuable, valuable information.
We're kind of making fun, but it's true.
No, I am serious about it. Hunters love storytelling. They're folklorists. They're raconteurs, right?
Well, they are. And, you know, hunting is a long-standing tradition. It's not just about going out in the woods and having a beer or whatever. You know, sometimes I think hunting gets a little bit of a bad rap, but it is a sport of kings.
Well, and also, as you put it so well in our After the Hunt cookbook, in all the different traditions, I mean, there's clothing of the hunt. Mm-hmm. We have a chapter called Dress to Kill.
That's right.
Talking about camouflage and uniforming, we talked about tools of the hunt. You know, where we're talking about hunting knives and guns, all the way back to the powder, the muzzle loaders, all the way back to the modern bows, and et cetera, et cetera. So to have these different resources as part of the topic today is really interesting, and it builds a great library, especially if you're a hunter, these type of books. So we do put them on the website.
Back in the day, when we talk about Renaissance and, you know, 1600s, 1700s, hunting castles were built, you know, like our good friend Louis.
Louis the 14th.
Versailles is really a hunting castle.
Right.
And there were many of them. And of course, there are the hunting tapestries that hung in the castles, which were beautiful, but they were also functional to keep the cold air a little bit out, I guess. But the plates and the silver, just phenomenal. And then, of course, there's a lot of Renaissance paintings centered around
some of the greatest paintings of the old masters. A lot of the hunting still lives, mm-hmm. that's being done. I mean, the Flemish artists, you know, Rubens and
He's fabulous.
Anthony Van Dyck and of course, Franz Schneider, who I know he did some of the massive paintings that we've seen on game. But who did the big tapestries of the wild animals that you and I went out to the Getty?
I think that was Ordoigne, Ordoigne.
Yeah, I think it was. And anyway, y'all, it's just beautiful, beautiful stuff. You know, the colonial French women in early New Orleans got very tired of eating corn, and they didn't know exactly how to cook a lot of these indigenous foods, and game certainly was one of them. Imagine coming to America and seeing raccoon and possum and some of the fish that were in the river that they had never seen before, the chupique and the garfish and these kind of things. So Bienville, our first governor, sent Madame Langlois, his housekeeper, who was well trained in the art of cookery, to live with the Indians for 6 weeks in the swamp of Louisiana, where she learned how to season and to add stuffings to wild game to enhance the flavor of it. And it was Madame Langlois who gave, actually, the colonial women the first cooking school, we think, in America that took place right here in Louisiana.
Not surprising.
I don't have to go to Rome for that. You know, I mean,
no.
Madame Langlois took care of it right here. Yeah, the women wanted to go back home to France because they said they were sick and tired of eating this corn. They weren't interested in it.
Well, they were tired of roughing it. Can you imagine? Not a grocery store in sight.
And so I've analyzed this. You see, these were the women who had grown kind of soft. I mean, these are the women of the 1680s. Now, had they been part of the Mayflower, you know.
You're kind of making fun, but there is truth to what you're saying, because a lot of the women who came from Paris really did not want to take part in the rural setting that they found themselves in, the rustic setting. That's why they started doing advertisements in Germany for farm women. Bring your farm daughters with you.
That's right. And it described them. And it said, please make sure that they can pull a plow.
No.
But, yeah, big German girls. They wanted big German girls who didn't mind work. That's the kind of women we were looking for here in the 1700s. I tell you what. Yeah, imagine how we've evolved to the point we are today. And no wonder things are so tough around the kitchen today. Huh, Michelle? I love the time of the Pilgrim, 1609, 1620. And those are good times, right? Those women really know how to cook.
Good times. And, yeah, nobody took a bath.
Good old days.
That was good old days.
That's exactly right. I mean, you were used to stand up to the climate, you know. Anyway, you ready for a little recipe, huh?
Please. please.
Well, what are you talking about? What's on the menu tonight?
Let me tell you, I could do venison ossobuco, which is the shank of venison, which is I absolutely love. Venison Wiener Schnitzel, which is just a pound out cutlet. But I've decided, because Michelle suggested it, that instead of my famous venison rolled roast, which, by the way, we'll have all of these recipes.
You can do
on,
that. I like all of these.
We're going to do these, but we're going to put them on the website. I think your idea of the spicy venison meatballs because of holiday parties coming up is a good choice.
A lot of holiday parties, a lot of people bring meatballs, but why not make it?
Yeah, well, you know, when cooking venison, I mean, making these tender meatballs are often a little kind of a tricky task, so to speak. So this little recipe I put together here makes a tender and juicy meatball every time. And it's a great, great, great little appetizer rather than your, you know, people come up with these little tired Swedish meatballs or these little beanie weenies. You know, leave those home. Come up with this robust, spicy venison meatball. Don't put a toothpick in it. Put one of those real serious forks down in there, you know. But anyway, so we're going to begin by making our venison meatballs. We're going to have 1 pound of ground venison, 1 pound of ground venison that we're going to mix equally with 1 pound of ground pork. Or if you want to keep it game, mix it with 1 pound of ground wild boar. Because you have the same amount of fat in the wild boar as you do those hunters who have
the pork.
Yeah, of course, absolutely.
You know, you can purchase game. I don't want to say wild game because you can't sell that across state lines, but like Texas wild game.
Oh, sure, there's a lot of wild game here, and the internet is a great source for finding everything. You type in wild boar meat for sale, you're going to find a couple hundred options. Absolutely. But anyway, a pound of ground venison, a pound of ground pork, put into a bowl, 6 eggs. Oh yeah, 6 eggs, Michelle, because that makes it nice and fluffy. You're going to have a cup of minced onions. Minced means not diced, it means very finely diced, but not quite a Bernoise, which is almost totally chopped. We're in the middle here. We're in a minced onion, 1 cup. 1 cup of minced celery, 1 cup of minced garlic. And the reason I'm mincing it is because this is a little meatball, because you're going to make a little cocktail meatball and you don't want big chunks of onion in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you're going to have a 1/4 cup of chopped basil, 1 3/4 cup Italian breadcrumbs. That's the seasoned Italian breadcrumbs. 1/2 cup grated Parmesan cheese, salt, and pepper to taste, including a little granulated garlic. And y'all, the key here is 2 things. Number one, that you have equal parts of pork to the venison. That's going to get you the fat and the juice you need. And that it is not overmixed. Now, Slime, I want you to hear this. The biggest problem that people have in making tender meatballs or hamburger patties or meatloaf is that they overmix it. Because when you
overmix it,
if you take that ground meat and you squeeze it and you squeeze it and you squeeze it, in culinary terms, it's called extruding the protein.
Extruding the protein.
That's right. And when you extrude the protein, it comes back solid. That's like when you debone a ham and you take the bone out and you put it back together, you tumble it and you massage the meat, and when you cook it, it comes back together. And you say, what happened with the bone? How did they cut the bone out of this thing? Well, that's what they did. They extruded the protein and they cooked it and it came back solid. So the same thing happens when you overmix meat to make a meatball. It'll become tough if you don't. So I always say keep your 4 fingers, Michelle, on your hand wide open an inch apart. See the way I'm doing here? Almost like the claw of an alligator. And then you put it down into the bowl and you mix it that way. Yeah, throw 3 fingers or 4. I use 4 fingers. I keep my thumbs put inside. And I mix my meat that way. Season, salt, and pepper to taste, right?
Okay.
And that way I'm not overworking and I'm definitely not extruding the protein, right?
What about all those eggs? That seems like that'd be hard to mix up in
The eggs makes it very easy because they're the liquid that makes it all come apart, and it's easy.
Dean asked a good question.
Would you beat the egg before you add it to the meat mixture, or would you just...
It depends how angry you are. If you're nice and quiet and calm, you throw the eggs just in, you just kind of break them up with your fingers. That's part of the fun. Certainly you can beat them first, absolutely. Plus you can mix all your seasonings in with the eggs and
then pour
it over. Absolutely. The important thing is that you don't overmix and squeeze the meat and like you're beating it up, because it's going to be tough, okay? So then you're going to set those aside, and then of course you can even put, if you want, a little jalapeno or something in there. Now I have to make the sauce, y'all. I have to get the sauce. You ready? And the sauce I'm going to use once again.
You're not going to do a little patty and taste it?
Well, of course I'm going to do a little patty and taste it. I need to season it. But I've got to put my sauce cooking first.
All right.
Okay, so you ready? I'm going to make my sauce. I'm going to have 1/2 cup of vegetable oil, and I'm going to have 1.5 cups, I'm sorry, of vegetable oil and 2 cups of flour, right? Then what I'm going to do is in a Dutch oven, I'm going to heat the vegetable oil, and using my wire whisk, I'm going to make a dark brown roux, because I'm putting a roux in this tomato sauce, which actually moves it into the category of a sauce piquant, right? A nice spicy sauce. You with me? So I'm going to go ahead and make my dark brown roux, and then when it gets to that 385 degrees, I'm going to throw in my 3 cups of diced onions, 1 cup of diced celery, 1 cup of diced bell pepper, 1/4 cup of minced garlic, and I'm going to saute that in the roux a little while. I'm going to put 2 8-ounce cans of tomato sauce, 1 10-ounce can of Rotel tomatoes, which is going to give it that good spiciness. A little dice of jalapenos will help too. And then once all the tomato and vegetables are cooked, I might add 2 quarts of beef stock or venison stock if you had the bones. And then a little green onions and parsley, bring it to a rolling boil, reduce it to simmer. And then you're going to cook it for about 45 minutes so that tomato sauce and that sauce piquant really gets nice. And then you're going to season it to taste, salt, pepper, granulated garlic. And you're going to add the raw little meatballs that's about the size of a golf ball down into the sauce while it's bubbling and simmering. Do not stir. You don't want to break the meatballs. Don't brown the meatballs first, because that cauterizes the outside and won't allow the sauce to enter or the juices to exit into the sauce. So you're missing a great flavor opportunity. And anyway, just make sure it's seasoned well. And this is going to make quite a few little servings. Now, of course, you can make big meatballs out of it as well and serve that sauce piquant. Anyway, y'all, the recipe's on the website. Everything's right there for you, including all the other recipes. And all I can say is, cook game. If you don't know how, buy a great game book. It's simple to do. If you hunt it, you kill it, you cook it. We'll see you next week.